With no fees or minimums, banking with Capital One is the easiest decision in the history of decisions. Even easier than deciding to listen to another episode of your favorite podcast. And with no overdraft fees, is it even a decision? That's banking reimagined. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. See CapitalOne.com/bank. Capital One N.A., member FDIC. Hey, everybody, if you want to tell the world something or sell the world something, head on over to Squarespace, because they're going to help you build the website of your dreams. Say you want to sell some custom merch. Well, you can set up your online store. Whether you sell physical, digital, or service products, Squarespace has the tools you need to start selling online. So go to squarespace.com/stuff right now, and you will face a free trial. And when you get ready to launch, use our offer code STUFF, and then you'll save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. How could you go wrong with Squarespace?
Hello, friends. It's me, Josh. And for this week's Select, I chose our September 2014 episode, How Animal Domestication Works. First, I want to congratulate you on being curious enough that you pressed play on what seems like it might be a very boring topic. But your adventurousness will be rewarded indeed, because this is one of those Stuff You Should Know episodes that sounds dull, but turns out to be super interesting. I hope you enjoy it and spend the rest of your day patting yourself on the back. Go ahead, you deserve it.
Welcome to Stuff You Should Know, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh Clark. There's Charles W. Chuck Bryant and our buddy Noel, who's producing us. Yeah.
Yep.
And that's Stuff You Should Know. The end.
How's it going?
Fine. Why are you asking?
It's just a friendly icebreaker.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. As if we didn't just record another show.
We did. Mm-hmm. It was on police interrogation.
That's right.
So, Chuck.
Yes.
You've heard of Jared Diamond before, right?
No.
Yes,
you have. It rang familiar.
He wrote Guns, Germs, and Steel.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
He wrote Collapse. He's known for that. Those two books.
I don't think I know that one.
I think it came after Guns, Germs, and Steel. But he wrote one of my favorite journal articles of all time. It's called The Worst Mistake in the History of the Human Race. About agriculture, about transitioning to agriculture.
I was going to guess on what that might be.
Oh, sorry.
That's right.
What do you guess that it's about?
No, agriculture.
Well, the thing is it may be the worst mistake in the history of the human race. I've talked about it a million times.
Yeah.
The article, that is. But he also wrote this really interesting article called Evolution, Consequences, and Future of Plant and Animal Domestication, which sounds extremely boring.
Yeah.
And it's in Nature, the journal Nature.
I bet it's not boring, though.
It isn't boring.
Yeah.
It's really, really interesting, because in it, he talks about animal domestication. And he says that it came about as a result of, typically, in about the same time as agriculture, the Neolithic Revolution.
Yeah.
Where we went from hunter-gatherers to agriculturists.
Yeah.
Right? To farmers. And everything changed. Like, we grew shorter in stature. Mm-hmm. Our brains grew smaller. Our jaws grew shorter.
Yeah.
We got just weird in a bunch of different ways.
Yeah.
Right? And it was as a result of agriculture. And if you look at what happens when we domesticate animals, when mm-hmm. we take them from the wild and we plant them next to us on a farm.
Yeah.
The same thing happens.
Yeah.
So his point is, what he's arguing is that not only did humans domesticate animals, humans in turn have become domesticated themselves through agriculture.
Yeah.
There's probably nothing that's had a greater impact, no single transition or change or concept that's had a greater impact on Homo sapiens than the Neolithic Revolution or the transition to agriculture.
Boom.
And a big part of that was the domestication of animals.
Yeah, they kind of went hand in hand.
In a hoof in hand, which to me is hilarious, because consider this. I think this is the funniest thing I've ever thought of in my life.
Oh, wow.
Imagine being an alien, come down to Earth.
All right.
And you're just walking along, taking everything in,
mm-hmm.
and you see a human riding a horse. And us, it's a human riding a horse. It makes utter and complete sense. But if you're an alien, you see an animal riding another animal.
Yeah.
And that would have to be the funniest thing you've ever seen, ever.
If you're a Martian?
Yeah. an animal riding another animal.
Yeah.
You know, like those little cowboy monkeys that ride dogs and stuff like that. It's hilarious. And that same thing, it's the exact same thing.
Or when you watch Planet of the Apes, an ape riding a horse.
That's not funny. That's unsettling.
That's terrifying. Yeah. That is the funniest thing ever you've ever said.
Yes. Yes, it is.
So, man, that was a good setup.
Thanks, man.
It's been a while since we've gotten an old Josh story.
I get really excited about anthropology.
Well, we are covering domestication, and I guess we should say off the bat that not everyone is on board. PETA, I had to look this up because I wasn't sure what their actual stance was.
Regarding animal domestication, you had to look that up?
No, about pets. Sure, I wondered. Officially, they are against pet keeping.
Sure.
But they know it's too late.
They hate pets.
But they know it's too late. They're like, we know we're not, what they are not for is for setting these animals free.
Here's why.
The original co-founder, I think, is Ingrid Newkirk, mm-hmm. is an animal abolitionist, but PETA's like, it's way too far gone. We don't want you to set these animals free, so we're going to fight our fight on spaying and neutering and reducing that population as much as possible.
Right.
But they are still officially against pets.
Right. But their position actually does make sense. It's extremely realistic because there is a strict definition of a domesticated animal.
Yeah.
And a domesticated animal is a species that was formerly wild that has been taken in by humans and whose characteristics have been so radically altered by humans that they can no longer feed themselves, typically.
Yeah, it's when we actually change their genetic makeup.
Yes, and part of that change, part of the characteristic change is that the food supply is controlled by humans. So if you put, say, an average dog out.
My dog Buckley would be dead inside 3 days.
Yeah, and somebody would say, well, they would forage through garbage. Humanity, if you took a dog out of any kind of human area,
yeah,
and put it in the area, it may return to a primal state, in which case that dog is reverted to a feral state.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a feral animal is one that was formerly domesticated and then went back to the wild.
Yeah.
If you take a single wolf and you teach it to jump up and grab beef jerky out of your hands,
yeah,
what you have there,
good
is
wolfie.
That's a tame wolf.
Yeah.
Now, a tame wolf could still go fend for itself. It's a tame individual. A domesticated animal is one that's born comfortable associating with humans.
Yeah, and there's exceptions, of course. Cats, the domestic house cat being one, you could drop a cat out in the middle of the woods.
Yeah.
And they would survive. They would hunt mice and eat mice or whatever, squirrels.
So the domestic cat is its own species.
Yeah.
But that raises some questions under Jared Diamond's definition, the stricter definition of
right.
a domestic animal. If a cat can just go, like, take care of itself, is it technically feral or is it ever really domesticated?
Yeah, or is it just an agreement, hey, I'll catch the mice in your house. And I like that wet food every day at 5 p.m., so I'll just hang out here.
Exactly.
And I like to sleep under your chin.
Like the cat has found an agreeable arrangement that it could take or leave at any time.
Yeah, mutually beneficial. And as we'll see, that's a consistent thing in the domestication of animals is that some people believe that it's good for the animal, it's good for the human.
Yeah.
And we have learned to scratch each other's backs in many different ways.
Literally, even in some cases.
So a little bit of a good background for this one might be to listen to our show on natural selection.
Yes.
Because, it covers natural selection. But there's another kind of selection called artificial selection
mm-hmm.
when it comes to domesticating animals. And that is not the same thing. That is when humans are choosing these desirable traits and making it so through breeding. Like the original horses, the first domesticated horses were
they
small.
Smoked cigars.
They did.
We broke them of that habit.
No, they were small like ponies. They were little ones, little wild horses in Mongolia. I think they call them the Zawalskis.
They're not a family in Pittsburgh.
No, it was a Russian army officer that they're named after. But when you start your name with three consonants, I never know which one is silent.
Oh, okay. So how do you spell it?
P-R-Z.
Oh, I was not going to guess that spelling.
E-W-Alski. So I'm just going to say Zawalski's horse. But people were at one point were like, man, I'd love to ride that thing, but he's too small. So find the biggest one that's a male and find the biggest one that's a female. And make them go have sex.
Right.
And maybe they'll have a bigger one, bigger son, and then make that one mate with someone big.
Right.
And eventually these things are going to be big enough to where we can ride them.
And then by proxy, throw away the ones that don't fit the criteria that we want.
Or use them for something else.
Sure.
Like food.
But that's what we did with dogs, too. Like, you got a bunch of different ones, right? Say big, small, soft, furry, fast, cuddly. And we said, well, we like this one for this, and we like that one for that. And so artificial selection was still going on. We were just spreading it out all over the place. With, like, say, a horse or something, we wanted bigger and stronger because we wanted to ride them. And we also wanted to, apparently, drink their milk. Which I did not know, but it makes sense that horses produce milk because they're mammals, but apparently our ancestors used to drink horse milk.
You never had horse milk?
No. I want to know if there's anyone out there listening who's tasted horse milk, please describe it.
Dude, someone out there is drinking horse milk right now while they're listening to this show.
One of our Mongolian listeners.
Straight from the teat.
I think they're like they use the horse for all sorts of stuff. The Mongolians, they're also like excellent riders.
Yeah, I think that Zawalski's horse is in Mongolia again.
Yeah,
after being nearly extinct. I might be wrong about that.
So, in addition to selecting the big horse, we also did some cool stuff with sheep. We we selected out there. They had longer, coarser hair that we didn't want. That's the Kemp.
Yeah.
We wanted the softer stuff that was inside, a.k.a. the wool, so we bred sheep that had more wool than Kemp until basically you can't find Kemp in sheep any longer.
And they were one of the first domesticated animals, right, the sheep?
Yep, they were. Chickens don't normally produce eggs as frequently as they do once they've been domesticated.
Yeah, they didn't use
And
to.
Like a Rhode Island Red will produce 5 to 7 a week. That's a lot of eggs.
Yeah, apparently the original chicken, too. I didn't look this up, but I remember a friend of mine that was a vegetarian. I witnessed an argument between a vegetarian and a meat eater, which is always fun because I don't get involved in that stuff. And I think one of them was like, well, look at the chickens. You know, what else are they going to do? You know, what are they good for? And he was like, dude, the original chicken wasn't anything like this chicken.
Yeah.
The original wild chicken was, like, taller and leaner and ran super fast. And
road runner.
I guess, yeah. I guess solve crimes and... and did all sorts of chickeny things that weren't just being slaughtered for food.
And apparently the first chickens were domesticated, they think, for cockfighting.
Yeah, for entertainment?
Yeah.
Crazy.
We have a shameful history, don't we?
As people, humans? Yeah. So Diamond, you would think if we can domesticate animals, why don't we just domesticate them all and use them for purposes? And Diamond writes that only about 14 animal species out of 148 canids have been domesticated, and that's because we can't domesticate every animal. There's certain things, there's certain criteria that even opens up the possibility.
Yeah, there's like a 6-point checklist, basically, and it's not progressive. If any one of these characteristics or traits isn't met, it pretty much just throws off the whole deal. So you got to have all six.
All right, those six are the first one is the right diet. If you're a picky animal, like what's the one that only eats bamboo?
The bamboo toad?
Those dumb koalas.
Koalas.
No, they eat eucalyptus.
Yeah. Man, I'm glad you remember that.
Yeah, you're not going to be able to domesticate a koala because what you want is something that you can feed in mass quantities on cheap, accessible food.
Oh, well, actually... Bamboo would be the way to go.
It's eucalyptus.
Yeah. I don't know how eucalyptus goes. If they ate bamboo, they'd probably be domesticated in that.
Well, no. By cheap, accessible food, I think they mean like millions of pounds of feed that you can put in a trough.
Dude, bamboo is like one of the fastest growing plants on Earth.
No, I realize that. I've got it in
my backyard.
Are we
still talking about eucalyptus?
But it's eucalyptus.
Yeah. But this bamboo thing, have you heard about bamboo? You know, I have a company that grows it.
Oh, Josh's Bamboo Floors?
Yeah.
The number two thing is a fast growth rate. So
they
gotta be able to grow quick, and so you can use them.
Yeah. So like if we'd figured out how to use gorillas to build skyscrapers, That'd be awesome.
Yeah.
But it would take forever to build a skyscraper because gorillas only reproduce fairly infrequently.
Okay.
So we need something that can build a skyscraper fast.
And that's why that didn't work.
Right.
When they tried it.
Yeah. But that one gorilla wearing that hard hat got a lot of laughs.
Friendly disposition. That's pretty clear. If you're a Kodiak bear, you're not going to be domesticated.
They tried that. They tried grizzlies at one point. That's a failed domestication.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Zebras very famously can't be domesticated.
Yeah, because I imagine people would be like, man, I want to ride that thing. It's cool looking.
Yeah, and it'll bite you to death.
Really?
Yeah. Apparently, in that Jared Diamond article, he says that zebras account for more injuries to zookeepers than any other animal at the zoo.
Man.
Yeah.
That is one pissed off, stripy horse.
Yeah.
They're not horses at all, though, are they?
They're related, for sure.
Well, yeah.
But the, so the zebras one, and then koalas, too, apparently are like ferocious little animals.
Well, they're tired of eating bamboo.
Eucalyptus.
Right. 1, 2, 3, 4. Easy breeding.
Yeah.
That's pretty obvious. You got to be able to pump out little baby puppies quickly.
Yes, because some animals like just shut down when they're captive. Like they don't breed. Like pandas have a lot of trouble breeding in captivity. Yeah. Cheetahs too.
Is that why it's always such a big deal when they're born at the zoo?
Or when like twins are born. Like at the Atlanta Zoo.
Oh, yeah.
Man, I don't know about zoos.
Well, we did a podcast on that.
I think that's the conclusion we came to, huh?
I think that was the title of it. Man, I don't know about zoos.
Yeah. What does it call? Are zoos good or bad for animals?
Yeah.
That was a good episode.
Yeah.
It's one of those long-lost, overlooked ones that are so good.
That's polarizing, too, man. I did some Facebook posting about killer whales in captivity, and people really feel passionately about...
Oh, the, like blackfish?
About supporting SeaWorld or not supporting SeaWorld. And that blackfish is a bunch of bunk. And apparently blackfish was highly manipulated, the documentary was. But at the end of all of that, I was like, I don't care. I just don't think they should be kept in captivity.
Yeah.
This one particular thing. But that was just me. Respect of a social hierarchy, that's a big one.
Big.
Because if you can't be the alpha dog and the leader of the pack, then you're going to have a very hard time domesticating that animal.
Yeah, but...
With a cat being an exception.
An animal that does follow a social hierarchy is basically prearranged to be domesticated.
Yeah.
Because you just take that alpha male, you punch him in the face a couple of times in front of everybody, make him cry, and then now you're the alpha male. And you say, start laying eggs. And they listen to you. And then they're domesticated, at least in that respect.
After you've punched the chicken?
Yeah. But that's a big one, is with that social hierarchy. It sets them up. They're predisposed to our method of domestication, which is listening to humans. And like sheep, it's mind-blowing because sheep, they're a herd animal that follows an alpha leader, right?
Yeah.
And so we have gotten we're just show-offs when it comes to animal domestication. We're so good that we've taken one of our domesticated animals, the dog, and put the dog in
charge of the sheep
as the alpha male of the sheep.
Yeah.
That's how sheep are herded. That's just showing off.
The aliens, that's another good alien laugh.
What, the double domestication
thing?
Yeah,
the dog leading the sheep.
Yeah.
And it's funny, too, if you've ever had a dog that's has the herding instinct, when you see that play out in your own home.
Yeah.
We used to see it all the time with Lucy. She would totally hurt us. And when we let her out in the backyard, she would walk the perimeter of the fence, you know, instead of running through the middle of it.
Yeah.
Very interesting stuff
to
see those original tendencies. And then the last one is they won't panic. If you have an animal that freaks out behind a fence.
Like deer?
Yeah. You're going to have a real hard time there. But like we said, there are exceptions because wolves were fierce and cats... don't follow a pack leader. And we're going to get to dogs and cats a little later. Stuff you should know. Hey, everybody. It's halftime and the scoreboard is not looking good. You're feeling low and not sure you can pull out a win. And that's when you have to dig deep, lift your head up, and say to yourself, time to get back in the game. Pull off some bank heists and take as much of your friend's money as you possibly can.
That's right. The smash hit mobile game Monopoly Go lets you compete with your friends to get the most riches and the biggest empire. It's the Monopoly you love, but on your phone, anytime, with tons of new twists, including leaderboards to compare your progress to your buddies.
That's right. You can play on countless dynamic Monopoly boards. You can make your friends bankrupt by smashing their landmarks with a wrecking ball, and you can charge other players rent for your iconic properties.
Plus, you can even work with your friends to crack open community chests in tournaments to get rewards and climb the leaderboard.
So get back out there, put on your game face, and download Monopoly Go, now free on the App Store or Google Play.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI and revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Stuff you
should know. So if you listen to our show on cave art, you know that, and on Egyptology, you know that animals...
What else? Mummification?
Yeah, probably so. You know that animals have been tied to humans for a long time and revered by humans for a long time, as evidenced by the fact that they buried them, and they mummified them, and they painted them on their walls.
Painted pictures of us riding them?
Yeah.
Yeah. They think that the... the first animal to be domesticated by far was the dog.
Yeah, how awesome is that?
Hunter-gatherer society and the dog were pals long before agriculture ever came along. But about the time of the agricultural revolution, which is, and get this, check this out.
Yeah.
10,500 years BP to about 4,500 years BP.
Now what's BP?
Before present.
Is that the new one?
Yeah. That's like the scientific way of saying it. There's no like 0 year or anything like that. Uh-huh. It's just 10,500 years before present.
Before present.
Before present. Not British.
That was New Zealand.
So basically, at some point about 10,500 years ago, what they think happened is the Earth's climate changed.
Uh-huh.
Maybe we killed off enough of the megafauna through overhunting or through climate change. They just went extinct. And about that time, some plants came around that we noticed we really liked. And maybe accidentally we started growing them. And then we figured out that we could just select these ones. And through a process of artificial and natural selection merged together, we got agriculture. And about that same time, we started to domesticate pigs, sheep, and cattle.
Yeah.
I think we're the big first three. And they still are the big three.
Oh, yeah.
Like, those are the money domesticated animals, you know?
Well, yeah, and like you said, it's tied to human natural selection as well, because if you are the tribe that has figured out how to keep cattle, then you're going to do better than your neighboring tribe that hasn't yet. And so you are going to be more successful as a civilization.
Yeah, you are. And you're going to conquer, like we talked about, and I think the royalty one. We talked a lot about tribes conquering other tribes through agriculture, through exporting agriculture. And as a result, Jared Diamond points out, 88% of humans alive today speak one of seven language families. And they come from two places in Eurasia, which were the first places for agriculture to take root. So basically, those tribes were so effective because of agriculture.
Yeah.
Today, we still basically, the vast majority of us speak one of seven language groups.
Wow.
That's crazy. Years, all these thousands of years later, that's how effective agriculture was at asserting authority.
We should do one on agriculture, the birth of agriculture.
I can't believe we haven't yet.
Yeah.
Let's do it.
Agreed. So back to animals. Here's a little breakdown of where some of your favorite animals came from. So in Southeast Asia is where you first got your goats, pigs, sheep, and dogs. Southwest Asia.
Yeah.
Move on over to Central
Asia.
That's
like Mesopotamia.
Okay.
These were the
birth of it all.
Yes.
Central Asia, you're going to get your chickens and your two-humped Bactrian. Is that how it's pronounced?
Yeah, it looks like it.
Camel. Central Asia.
Yeah, and those camels were actually well-known for long hair, and they can survive in cold climates.
Yes, and they're not just desert dwellers, right?
No. And apparently when they were domesticated, it created such a revolution that some societies stopped using the wheel. Because they're like, we don't need the wheel anymore.
Yeah.
We got camels.
Like the wheel left altogether and then came back.
Yeah.
When someone said, cars are pretty cool too.
Yeah.
Actually, it was much sooner than that. Arabia is where you have the Arabian camel with the single hump. China, they domesticated pigs and the water buffalo and dogs. Move over to the Ukraine and you've got the wild tarpon horses.
Yeah.
And that's what most folks think are the original horse.
Right.
Even though I read about the small ones in Mongolia.
The
yeah.
Wisniewski or the...
the Kowalski.
Yeah, the Kowalski family.
Yeah, I'm going to have to look that up. And then Egypt, you've got your donkeys. And then South America, you've got your llama and your alpaca. Llama as a beast of burden and the alpaca for their soft wool.
And the guinea pig for their meat.
Ooh, really?
Yeah.
In South America?
Yeah. The Andes.
I don't want to eat a guinea pig.
That's what they were bred for originally.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And those were some of the earliest ones. And Jared Diamond, again, who I know I keep citing him, but man, this guy's great ideas.
Is he alive?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So he's a modern man?
Yeah. He's got a little beatnik pointy beard and everything.
Really?
And yeah. He's a good guy.
Let's get in touch with him.
Okay. Attention, Jared Diamond.
Yeah.
Please contact us for reasons we'll figure out later.
Yeah. StuffPodcast@HowStuffWorks. Put in the subject line, I'm Jared Diamond.
There you go.
And now we're going to get 500
fake
crackpots.
It'll be Lou Bega posing as Jared Diamond.
Nice one.
So Diamond pointed out that over the last 1,000 years, only one substantial animal has been added to the list of domesticated animals. So basically, we were good at it to start, and we did everything we could. Basically, almost all animals that are going to be domesticated on Earth have been domesticated.
Was it the hamster?
Probably. It was the reindeer.
Oh, the hamster wasn't until 1930, though.
Yes, I know. And if you read that, that's technically a tamed animal.
Oh, it's not domesticated?
Not under the strictest definition, where it's like the animals are born
And they're genetically modified.
They're comfortable around humans. They're born that way. With a tamed animal, you're like inventing the wheel with each individual organism.
Gotcha.
With a domesticated animal, you've taken a wild species and you've selected it enough so that when an animal is born, it's cool being around a human. Whereas like if you're around like a gerbil or a hamster baby, it's not going to be cool around you. It doesn't have, you know, thousands of years of genetic information telling it that from birth it can be comfortable with you because you're going to give it some pellets to eat.
Okay. Whereas a dog, a puppy will just automatically snuggle up with you.
Right. But think about getting close to a wolf pup. It's going to be problematic. Let's go try right now. Did you ever see that movie Never Cry Wolf? The Disney movie from like the mid-80s that was
no.
so good?
Uh-uh.
It wasn't.
Oh wait, yeah.
It was live action.
Ethan Hawke?
No, it was way before his time.
No. I totally know what you mean. I can picture the guy in my head.
He like goes and lives with the wolf by himself.
Yeah, I saw it.
Man, it's a good movie.
Yeah, he was in. I can't remember. He was in another movie.
So when we did domesticate it, like I said, we took a wild animal, it underwent a process through artificial selection to where it just became something different.
Yeah.
And there's certain traits that they're not quite sure how they happen, but they're clearly linked to the genes that lead to domestication,
mm-hmm.
that take an animal and turn it from wild to tame to domesticated, that have outward signals and signs, like floppy ears.
Yeah.
The only other animal in the wild that has floppy ears is the African elephant.
Yeah.
Every other animal in the wild has perky ears.
Yeah.
But it's almost like it's a signal like, okay, we're tame now. Our ears don't need to perk up.
It totally is.
Smaller brain size.
Yep. They don't need to be as smart over the years if you're feeding, as evidenced by my dumb dog, Buckley. Like I said, he wouldn't survive 2 days in the wild.
Yeah.
My neighbor one time left his dog out all night by accident. Uh-huh. And I was going out to the car the next morning, and this big Rottweiler comes running over at me. And I was like, at first, I was like, oh, man.
Yeah.
And then I realized it was Carter. And I went and banged on his door, and he finally woke up, and he was like, Carter's in here. I was like, I don't think so. And he had come home from a long night and let him out and forgot to let him back in.
Yeah.
And little Carter just slept on the front porch.
Oh.
It was like the sweetest thing ever. But Carter survived, is my point.
By sleeping on the front
porch. By sleeping on the front porch and being like scratching on it, like, please let me in.
Yeah.
So, yeah, smaller brains, curly hair, sharp sense of sight and hearing.
Well, it's lessened.
Yeah, it's lessened because they don't need that stuff either.
Right. Because they're being cared for by humans. The humans are saying, you just get dumb. We're in charge now.
Yeah.
We'll teach you everything you need to know. We got a lot of this data, this information, from a...
Jared Diamond?
not even. A very famous study that went on for about 40 years by a Russian geneticist named Dmitry Belayev. And Belayev said, hey, I'm going to figure out how domestication actually works. And I'm going to take silver foxes, and I'm going to compress the domestication process. And basically, over the course of like 30 or 40 years, even after he died, his colleagues and interns and assistants carried on this experiment. So it's been going on for maybe 50 years.
Oh, wow.
And they've found that you can get predictable results from domesticating animals. And they've domesticated some silver foxes. Their ears started getting floppy. Their skulls started to get smaller. They started to get curly hair. Some of them started to bark. And they were born comfortable around humans.
Yeah, and here's the thing. If you've seen, there's a really cute video on the internet about a little fox getting his belly rubbed.
Yeah.
It looks sort of like dogs.
Yeah.
But they are DNA evidence. They have pretty much proven that dogs are descended from the Asian gray wolf.
Right.
And have nothing to do with foxes. But that's just proof through this experiment that taming and domesticating this animal can lead to these traits.
Yeah, because a lot of people are like, how do you get a Pomeranian from a gray wolf pug from a gray wolf or something like that? Have you seen that picture of that pug who is clearly messing around with a crawfish?
No.
And gets his tongue bit, and it's like in midair, and, you know, they have huge eyes that are bulging out anyway.
He's trying to, like, have sex with a crawfish?
No. Like, he was sniffing it, and I guess the crawfish, like, grabbed onto his tongue, and now the crawfish is hanging onto his tongue, and
gotcha.
Is in midair as the pug's, like, squealing or whatever. It's hilarious. Anyway, they figured out that because of domestication, these traits change. And like I said before, with... you know, different kinds of dogs, you get different kinds of, well, different looking dogs that we've selected for over time.
Yeah, and it didn't take that long, apparently. Apparently, with canines specifically, selective breeding can affect a species really rapidly. And there's been evidence of Pekingese dogs as far back as 1st century AD China.
Mm-hmm.
So they weren't wolves for long once we decided. And, you know, there's different theories on how that very first happened. One of them, which I like, is that people found abandoned pups, and it's just a natural human instinct to see a little puppy and care for it. So they said, yeah. Well, let me take this little wolf puppy because it needs a home.
We should talk about the science of cute sometime. It's really interesting, like why we find things cute.
An email the other day.
We'll have to do that one.
So, yeah, that's one of the theories. The other one is that... maybe some of the more tame wolves would rummage around our garbage and for food. And so if you were a more tame wolf, you were more likely to survive. And eventually that would evolve into a more dog-like species.
Yeah, because the human garbage pile was much more reliable source of food than, say, like whatever was growing in the wild. So
exactly.
They would be – that's natural selection basically through artificial means almost.
Yeah.
But either way, they think that dogs – descended from wolves or diverged from wolves as long as 100,000 years ago, but they didn't really start to undergo the drastic morphological changes until maybe 15,000 years ago.
Yeah.
And again, all of this predates the advent of agriculture, so that means that hunter-gatherers and dogs were friends for a while, and they think that the reason that happened was because they figured out that a dog could go flush out some quarry,
yeah,
a hunter-gatherer could spear it and then tear off a piece and give the dog some and eat some himself, and they had a symbiotic hunting relationship that was aces.
Yeah, like we said earlier, mutually beneficial. It was great for the dog. They were fast and fierce, and we were smart. And because we already mentioned dogs are innately want to follow a lead dog, an alpha dog,
yeah,
it was kind of like the perfect relationship.
And it has been ever since.
Yeah, and one of the other cool things about the domestication of the dog is they, in ancient Rome, apparently, women is where they had the first evidence of little lap doggies, because they were supposedly cured stomach aches. Which, of course, they didn't, but I think it just made someone feel better having a little dog curled up on their lap. So how's your tummy feel now?
So we selected them for that. We selected, I don't know, sheepdogs to herd and terriers to catch rats. And,
yeah,
you know, that explains all this variation in dog breeds.
Yeah, I saw a cool special on it the other day. It was on, I think it was on Animal Planet, but it wasn't one of those just like, look how cute everything is.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of like the science behind the history of these animals. It was really cool.
Gotcha. So let's take a break and we'll come back and we'll talk about cats and other stuff too, right after this. Stuff you should know.
Hey everybody, it's halftime and the scoreboard is not looking good. You're feeling low and not sure you can pull out a win, and that's when you have to dig deep, lift your head up, and say to yourself, time to get back in the game. Pull off some bank heists and take as much of your friend's money as you possibly can.
That's right. The smash hit mobile game Monopoly Go lets you compete with your friends to get the most riches and the biggest empire. It's the Monopoly you love, but on your phone, anytime, with tons of new twists, including leaderboards to compare your progress to your buddies.
That's right. You can play on countless dynamic Monopoly boards. You can make your friends bankrupt by smashing their landmarks with a wrecking ball. And you can charge other players rent for your iconic properties.
Plus, you can even work with your friends to crack open community chests in tournaments to get rewards and climb the leaderboard.
So get back out there, put on your game face, and download Monopoly Go, now free on the App Store or Google Play.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI and revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Stuff you should know. Okay, so cats don't follow an alpha male, which leads to a puzzle of how they could possibly have been domesticated. And if you talk to certain people, they may not have ever really been domesticated.
Yeah, cats don't look different than their ancestors.
Right, which means that it makes it tough to go back and compare modern cats to the cats in the fossil record and say, oh, they diverged X number of years ago or whatever.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite things about cats is when you look at a cat in the backyard, you know, crouched down to leap on the bird, it looks just like a big lion about to leap on the big bird.
The thing is, they're pretty sure that cats did not diverge from big cats like lions. They think they came instead from a couple of different wildcats, a European wildcat and an African wildcat. And both of those are still around today. And they think that that's what the cats last common ancestors were.
Yeah, if you look at it, it relatives. Looks like it.
Yeah.
Like if you look up the African wildcat, it looks like just a bigger version of a tabby.
Yes. And they don't know exactly when they were domesticated, but there's evidence that as far back as 9,500 years ago, there's at least one gravesite where a cat was clearly buried with a human, which indicates yeah. some sort of importance and familialness with a cat.
Yeah, in ancient
I don't think it was
Egypt,
accidental.
They love cats and dogs.
Right.
And I think cats were even had like religious significance, but or maybe both of them did. But because Anubis, that was the dog, right?
I don't remember. I just remember Horus was the hawk.
Right.
Right?
But ancient Egyptians loved their dogs and cats.
Or was Horus the dog?
I think Anubis was the dog.
So, again, cats probably are not technically domesticated. But
well, the reason why we took them in, though, is the same reason that some people still take them in now is because they're good mousers.
Right. That, and that's pretty much the explanation for domestication in a lot of ways. Like the animals were useful for work.
That's right.
Some of the other animals, very ancient domesticated animals that we domesticated for work. And I guess I should say it wasn't just for work. Probably initially we domesticated animals for a food supply, like their milk.
Yeah.
Things like cattle, cows, we domesticated them for milk, of course.
Yeah, their ancient ancestor, it's now extinct, called the Auroch.
Mm-hmm.
And, that's what led to modern tame cattle, apparently.
Right. Oxen, we domesticated them for work, although there's milk from them. You can pretty much drink milk from anything.
Yeah, and
any
the ox,
mammal.
I think, was, you can milk anything.
Right.
Just a little milking. The ox, I think, was even stronger than the cow, and they would pull initially sledges,
mm-hmm.
like put a bunch of junk on that thing and pull it over here, and then eventually plows and, of course, wheeled wagons. And some say that we wouldn't have even gotten to where we were with the wheel if it hadn't been for things like ox.
Yeah, because we would have had to pull it.
Yeah, and that's no good.
No. Sheep, we eventually figured out that we could breed them for their wool. Although apparently there was a 5,000-year differential between the time we domesticated sheep and the time we started using wool.
Clothing. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Before the loom or yeah. before they started weaving by hand.
Yep.
Goats. Goats are great because they'll eat anything. So they're super useful. You can be on infertile, rocky land, and a goat is pretty happy. They're great climbers.
Yeah. Eat them?
Yeah, got meat, unfortunately.
You can make cheese out of their milk.
Yeah.
Did you know that cashmere comes from goats?
Yeah, and mohair.
I did not know that.
Yeah?
Did not know that.
I think they're just good for looking at and thinking they're cute.
Sure. That's one thing.
Pigs, of course, are descended, domesticated from the wild boar. And pigs were domesticated mainly because they would eat waste and trash. And so they were handy to have around because they would eat our trash and then we would eat them.
Right. And you know, it's interesting. North America has a pretty fascinating history as far as domesticated animals go. With pigs in particular, the wild hogs in North America
uh-huh.
were not around. There are a couple of pig-like animals, but there's no true wild pigs in North America, or there weren't until the 16th century when De Soto brought a bunch of domesticated pigs who wandered off, some of which wandered off,
uh-huh.
and became the wild hogs of the Americas.
Well, that's the same thing happened to the horse.
Exactly.
They originally came over on the Bering Land Bridge and then went extinct, and then the Spanish brought them over, and they said, hey, I don't know why there aren't horses here already, because this is pretty great.
Yeah.
The horses said that.
And some of them went feral, and now you have the horses on Cumberland Island.
Yeah, they're still wild, aren't they?
Yeah.
That's pretty amazing.
Unless they're faking it.
No. Cumberland Island is here in Georgia, for those of you that don't know. We're not talking about some like South American country.
No, Cumberland Island.
Yeah, right here in the South.
Right.
And you know what's cool is, and for me, this is the fact of the podcast. After the horse, the next step forward in speed transportation
mm-hmm.
was 5,000 years later with the steam train.
Yeah. That's
like,
why we
for
still 5,000
years.
Yeah.
Horses were as fast as we could go, and
you know, tie up 12 of them to that stagecoach, and we'll be 12 horses strong.
Yeah.
But, yeah, for 5,000 years, it's just amazing.
Yeah.
And then finally they invented the steam engine, and the horses were like, all right.
Fine, we'll go over here.
apparently, at first, they were used for their meat and their milk.
Yeah, horse milk. Again.
Again, and then they were used as a mode of transportation.
Donkeys, also good for transporting.
Yeah, like we said, in Egypt.
Yeah, they came out of Egypt. Camels, good for transporting. You got a couple of different kinds, the Bactrian and the Arabian camels. And the just using animals for transport and for work kind of allowed for not only the agricultural revolution to take hold, but for it to spread as well through trade routes and stuff that allowed humans to just move longer distances faster. So that was another big way that domestication changed humanity. It helped us spread like a plague over the face of the earth.
So we could ruin everything.
Yeah.
I guess we can talk about some other smaller livestock like chickens and roosters.
Mm-hmm.
Like you said earlier, this was, I think, maybe the second fact of the show, is possibly domesticated for entertainment as cockfighters.
Yeah.
Which is sad.
Yeah.
Turkeys, I didn't know this. They were the one of the few indigenous North American domesticated animals.
Yeah. Mesoamericans domesticated them.
Who knew?
I didn't know that either. Although, if that floats your boat, you should read 1493, because stuff like that comes up in it a lot.
Man, I just need to read both those at some point.
I can't believe you haven't.
I know.
Here's another one. Bees. We domesticated bees, I'm sure, through a very long and painful process. This is discussed in 1493 as well.
Yeah.
So we domesticated bees, and we used bees to help us with another domesticated organism, the almond tree.
Oh, yeah?
So that's another one. That's like sheepdogs herding sheep.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But this is bees pollinating almonds.
Yeah. Well, bees, we did a great episode on that. That's how we sweetened everything for many, many years, and still do, using honey.
Yeah.
But
I did last night. It's still delicious.
In a cocktail?
No, on a biscuit.
Oh, nice. A little honey on a biscuit?
Yeah.
Did you make the biscuit yourself?
Yumi did.
Nice. From scratch?
No.
From the can?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Those are good, though.
Oh, yeah.
You know what's real good, I've noticed, is the frozen ones in the bag instead of the can. They rise a lot more like a traditional Southern biscuit to me.
We wanted just like a nasty, buttery,
Pillsbury,
like layer biscuit, you know? Yeah,
the flaky good. Layers?
Yeah.
Man, those are good.
Yeah.
And it's always fun to open the package, too.
And it's delicious with honey.
But thanks to a man named L.L. Langstroth, he is the guy who really made beekeeping. There were a lot of people working with frames already, but he's the first guy that made removable and movable frames.
Yeah.
Which apparently bees will have a tendency to tie their honeycombs into the wall of the box, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
And with those removable and movable frames, they couldn't do that anymore. And apparently that made it really easy to manage them.
Yeah.
So thanks to him in 1852.
Smart guy.
We could domesticate those bees for their delicious honey.
And so here's where it comes, kind of falls apart for me.
Yeah.
I could see saying bees are domesticated.
Sure.
They don't sting you. They're used to being around people.
Yeah.
Silkworms?
Yeah.
No.
No.
No. Rabbits? No. I would say that you can tame a rabbit, but for the most part, they're not domesticated.
Okay.
And then the same with hamsters, which I didn't realize that they were this recent.
Yeah, from 1930. And another fun fact is supposedly the entire population of tamed hamsters derives from that one hamster family.
Yeah.
Because they make so many little hamsters so quickly.
Yep.
So you take issue with silkworms, rabbits, and hamsters.
I do.
As tamed but not domesticated.
Yes.
Like the elephant. Just because Hannibal rides an elephant doesn't mean it's domesticated.
It meant he had a tamed elephant to ride. And Chuck, just before we wrap up, I mentioned that humans in turn have been domesticated by agriculture.
Yeah.
And we have. Like, we've undergone a lot of the same changes that domesticated animals undergo when we domesticate them. Like, our reproductive period has increased.
Yeah.
Because we don't have to carry a kid like 10 kilometers every day because we're not hunter-gatherers, so we can have more kids.
Yeah, just get on the horse and
right all over town.
Exactly. And one of the other ways that we've changed, in addition to some of us becoming lactose tolerant into adulthood,
yeah,
is we've become ravaged by and also immune to a lot of diseases,
yeah,
a lot of epidemic diseases, which couldn't have ever existed prior to the advent of agriculture for two reasons. One, it needs a dense human population that agriculture supports, mm-hmm, for it to be spread around and contracted and to really gain steam.
Yeah.
And then secondly, it also requires a lot of repeated close proximity to animals. And it turns out that all of our epidemic diseases come from the agricultural revolution and are hanging out with livestock a lot.
Yeah.
Like, for example, influenza came from pigs and ducks.
Yeah.
Measles and tuberculosis came from cattle.
Yeah.
Possibly smallpox came from cattle, if not camels.
Yeah.
And then get this. The very fact that all of these, almost all of these worst epidemic diseases have their origins in Eurasia,
mm-hmm,
mean that that's because our domestication took place in Eurasia, which means that the people of Eurasia were able to develop resistance and immunity over the generations to these diseases.
So they don't get these diseases as much?
No. And when we came over, that's what wiped out the North American New World,
right,
populations, because they didn't have any resistance to these diseases. Man. So you can really make a case that agriculture changed everything more than anything else ever has.
Wow.
So that's that. You got anything else?
I got nothing else.
Man, you need to read 1491 and 1493.
I'll do that tonight.
Okay. If you want to know more about animal domestication, you can type those two seemingly boring but rather fascinating words into the search bar, howstuffworks.com, and that will bring up this article. And then since I said search bar, it's time for listener mail.
I'm going to call this Nielsen family. We heard from quite a few. Got quite a few people that showed pictures of their little, like, $2 and $3 packets.
Yeah.
Which is kind of neat. I don't think it's even $5 anymore. I think a couple of people just got $2.
Apparently, they give you two to sweeten the pot, and then once you do it, you get more.
Huh.
That's what I think. That's what somebody, I think, said.
Well, this is from a real deal Nielsen family that got paid, and they're from Atlanta, from Grant Park. Apparently, our address was picked at random by their computer program, and they sent out a representative with a gift set of ugly tumblers to convince us to participate. We agreed because they pay you about $200 every 6 months if you let them track your TV and computer usage. Rob, who was the representative, came by and installed the TV box and computer program and would check in on us in person every 6 months and ask a set of questions about our life and purchasing habits. They always asked about table wine, which I thought was interesting. I know. Every time we turned on our TV, they would have loved me because I would just be drunk on table wine the whole time. Every time we turned on the TV or opened up our laptop, we had to press a button about who was watching and using the computer. It wasn't that hard, but it became annoying after a couple of years, so we were happy when our contract ended. Apparently, they were really excited to have us as a part of their program because we were what they call a Grand Slam family, which means we were young, under 30, with over-the-air TV, no cable, like antenna.
All right.
And we owned a Mac. So that's a grand slam, apparently. it seems
clears the basis.
Yeah, I guess so. It seems like we were a pretty rare find in the world, in their world, so rare that when our two-year participation ran out, they had offered us a year-long extension. We also got a bonus payment for being a minority household, which is hilarious because both of us are white as can be, but my husband is half Cuban. So that is from Laura and Chris right here in Atlanta.
Nice.
Laura and Chris Nielsen.
Yeah, they're the Nielsen family.
No cable, under 30 Mac users.
The Grand Slam.
The Grand Slam.
If you are a Grand Slam family of some weird sort, we want to hear from you. You can tweet to us at SYSK Podcast. You can join us on Facebook.com/StuffYouShouldKnow. You can send us an email to StuffPodcast@HowStuffWorks.com and check out our home on the web, StuffYouShouldKnow.com.
Stuff You Should Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today. Health Aid kombucha.
The first cell phone was demonstrated in 1973 by Martin Cooper. But you know what wasn't demonstrated? Shared plans. Over 50 years later, you can save on one line, thanks to Visible. It's true. So switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon for just $25 a month, taxes and fees included. Switch now at Visible.com.
Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.